we're all hooked together in one way or another. It's just how we perceive that matrix. Some of us can push more of that veil away and see what's there. And some of us are very locked down and don't want to see anything. There is something that connects us all together. And you can either choose consciously or unconsciously to see it, and how you use that knowledge differentiates us.
Hey folks, welcome to the Brilliant Body Podcast, a forum to learn about and liberate the brilliance of your body and ultimately to expand the meaning and experience of intelligence. Join me, Ali Mazay, and other body masters to explore pioneering and varied perspectives on what it means and feels like to be embodied. So many people feel disconnected from their bodies due to emotional or physical pain, or even conditioning and lack of education. Others feel quite at home in their bodies, yet want to learn to have more pleasure, awareness, and access to the body's guidance. This podcast is for everybody. Each one of my trailblazing guests has studied their own bodies and others' bodies for decades and will share their expertise and unique mission, how to thrive as a body. So join us and reclaim your body's brilliance. This conversation explores the body through the extensive experience of a hands-on practitioner, two of us actually. While past episodes delved into the philosophical underpinnings of embodiment, this installment offers some insight on how Holden Zalma's brilliant body is informing the healing process of so many. With over 30 years of hands-on experience and a staggering 300,000 massages under his belt, Holden isn't just an expert practitioner, he's a healer. His groundbreaking approach, Myo Align, goes beyond traditional massage therapy by addressing the root causes of pain and discomfort, not just the surface symptoms. His personalized treatments have earned him accolades from medical professionals, industry leaders, and most importantly, his countless satisfied clients. Having also been a body worker for decades, I can attest not only to the effectiveness of Holden's practice, but also really enjoy talking shop with another master practitioner. Let's hear from the brilliant-bodied Holden Zalma. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Good. I'm excited to see you.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been so long, at least a couple of days.
So I'm going to introduce you officially.
Okay, then.
I welcome you to the Brilliant Body. And I know from speaking to you that you've got a lot of, I would go so far as to say, revolutionary ideas about how to practice, how to approach the body. And I wanted to invite you to participate in this conversation today because I want to know more about how you actually perceive the body, not just treat the body. How do you evaluate? As soon as somebody walks in your door, what are you looking at? Because I notice every time a body walks by me on the street, anywhere I'm around bodies, I am looking, I'm scanning them, I'm feeling them in my own body. I want to know how you perceive bodies.
So the way I look at people is it's first visual. It's like when they're walking into the room, I'm watching them. I'm looking at how their shoulders hold, their head sits. Are they limping on one side? Are they favoring one piece? When they're talking to me, what are they doing? Are their arms crossed? Are their shoulders high? Are their legs crossed? I'm picking up on all these micronic subtle cues because not only is it telling me what physicality is going on, but what's emotionally going on. You can tell somebody's complete emotional state just by their body posture. If their shoulders are shrugged up to their ears, if they're rolling forward, there's all these different little nuances. Are their hands in their pockets? Are they crossed? So it's diagnosing what's going on mentally with them from a physical standpoint. Then you take that and then we go into the actual kind of evaluation where I do a gait analysis. I have them walk down the hallway. I see where they're striking, what's going on with their foot. Are their arms swinging? Is their head moving? Is their balance and is their symmetry? And if there's not symmetry, none of us are completely symmetrical, but if there's an imbalance, you can see it. It's like a flashing light to me. I had PTs that used to work with me and for me. And I'd say, do you see that? And they're like, what? I'm like, why? Right there.
Yeah. Well, it's like asking a good musician whether they can hear what those with perfect pitch can hear. There is a sensibility, both innate, I believe. Some of us are just body-based people. We were just born that way and then spend gazillions of hours honing that skill, those sensibilities, that way of perceiving, which obviously you have. I have. That's a thing which is so interesting, audience. Just know there are those of us out there who are paying attention to stuff, as are all of you out there paying attention to things you and I, Holden, aren't paying attention to while we're busy looking at all the stuff that's going on in people's bodies and feeling it. You are one of the best fixers I've ever met. And that is very much what you're after. A lot of us, that's not what we're looking to do. So first, I want to zoom in on your view on fixing in the first place and whether bodies can be quote unquote fixed.
I'm very resolution based. I want to see change. I want to see a progression. I want to see improvement. I want to see range of motion. So when I see a body, the things I'm looking for are restrictions, abnormalities, compensations, and how the body will deal with different things that have happened to it over time. I call it Holden's law of compensation. So if I got a crick in my neck, I want to walk forward, but now my whole body has to torque to make that motion that doesn't happen in my neck anymore. So then now my hip's hurting. And then I have to go forward because now the hip's hurting too much because I'm trying to compensate from not doing that until that keeps going, going, going till you fall. So I say that the body's really good at compensating, but it has a finite number. And when it hits that finite number, everything goes to shit. So a lot of times when I see people is that shit point.
Yeah.
And I have to trace back where it came from because the final symptomology is the end of that entire chain. And if all I'm going to do is address that one little piece, it's going to reoccur. It's going to reoccur because you're not getting to why it happened.
I do want to ask you, though, as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking about the ancestors, the elders of our profession who did so much work on emotional anatomy. I'm thinking about Ida Rolph. I'm thinking about these people that came before us that really pioneered this stuff. Wilhelm Reich, when in his case, he ended up in jail for how progressive his work was. So I was curious, these things you described about the emotional and psychological correlations with body posture and holding, whether or not that was something you learned from observation and from talking to people and applying your psychology degree, and or did you actually read about these correlations that predecessors or contemporary practitioners have observed?
I think it was a combination of both.
Yeah.
You'd learn certain things, or I'm like, oh, I never thought about thinking it that way. And then you see it and you're like, oh yeah, that makes more sense. And then the other thing is, the more you deal with a population, you see commonalities and you see deviance. So you see things that are, this is where it should be. And then when it's off, why? And if you can figure out what's causing that why, that's when you can actually get to the deeper reason and solutions and pathways to help them out of that. There's a lot of talk therapy that happens because it's not just the physical aspect of it. It's, what are you holding on to? What is that emotional lock or that trigger that will not allow you to move past something? Because if you're stuck in that one place, it doesn't matter what we physically do. You're holding on to it because you need to. There's a reason for that.
I have sobbed multiple times on your table.
I have a tear bucket that just sits there.
You also have made me laugh uproariously countless times. Your humor is one of my favorite things about you, I have to say, Holden.
Thank you. Remember, we were talking a little bit about how a man can deal in this industry and create comfort and security. I learned really early on, this is a profession. Hi, how are you? Shake your hand, take all your clothes off, let me touch you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You have to build rapport fast. Mm-hmm. And I did that with humor. And that was one of the things I prided myself on. And I teach my therapists a lot. You know, you might be good at what you're doing, but if you don't know how to talk to somebody and they don't know who you are, they're scared the whole time. There's that restriction. There's that, I don't know what this person's doing to me. I make it a point before I touch you, you know who I am, what my intentions are, and the type of personality I am, and my goal with you, which is compassion and care, and I want the best for that person at that moment.
I am always paying attention to safety as well. It's the first thing that does or doesn't happen when people encounter you. And it is amazing what that is for people to trust us with their naked bodies immediately, often as strangers. It is a big damn deal. There is a sacred responsibility. I would even say a sacred oath, not unlike that medical professionals take, that doctors take. These people are literally in our hands. And I love that you're clarifying how much goes into what looks like a casual, breezy way of being. It is conscientious and intentional what you're doing. Yeah. So how did you even get into this line of work?
I got into it by accident. It was originally my thought process when I was going to school. I was like, oh, physical therapy is the way to go because you could make a decent amount of money. I got to interact with people. I got to do things that I thought I wanted. My dad was an attorney. I was like, I don't want to be stuck in a courtroom or reading and everybody be angry at me constantly. Let's figure out another path. And also, I noticed I was very good at dealing with people. So the psychology route was interesting to me. So the combination of the mind and the body seemed like a good mix. So I went to school thinking I was going to PT school. So I enrolled at USC, got a degree in psychology, and was doing my pre-med PT at the same time. So I was talking to a buddy of mine at school, and I said, you know, we don't learn anything about what we're going into until we graduate. I'm like, how is that a good scenario? I'm devoting my entire life to something I have no idea about. So I said, do you know any place I could get some experience doing this stuff? He's like, oh, there's the training room. I said, what the hell is the training room? He's like, oh, it's where all the athletes go to get fixed because, you know, they're getting all bumped and bruised from all the things they're doing. So I said, okay, I'll go check it out. And the guy that was running it, I went down. I said, I hear you do internships. Do you have any openings? He's like, nope. I said, when will you? He's like, I don't know. I said, okay, I'll come back. I came back every day for 3 months. And I think he hired me so he'd see me less. I saw it as an opportunity. I'm like, look at all these cool people I can sponge off of and learn and ask a lot of questions that are at the top of their field. So we had everything from chiros to PTs to neurosurgeons to cardiologists to orthopedics. Everything you could imagine would walk through that door. So I made it my mission. Any new person that would come there, I'd watch what they do. I'd ask so many questions that they'd probably hate me by the end of the day. But then, all right, that works. How can I manipulate that into something that would be even better into my skill set? And where the other trainers would probably see 4 to 5 kids a day, I'd see 30 because they'd all start coming to me because I'd do everything that they wouldn't because I wanted to get them better. And I also wanted to try what I was learning.
You also have this fabulous capacity to integrate what could seem like disparate disciplines, and you are able to find the through line and integrate them, not just in your mind, but into your hands.
Definitely. I saw medicine as very myopic. They were super hyper specialized. We always used to say, if you go to a cardiologist with a foot problem, he's going to tell you it's your heart because that's the line that they want to stay in and don't want to go past that line. The human body is one giant unit and it works integrated as a piece, not separate pieces, not separate parts, which unfortunately medicine does. They lock you into different parts. And I was like, well, the mind plays a huge role. The body plays a whole huge role. The emotional state, the activity, what's the routine, what's happening at home, all that plays into how that injury will be processed and how the problem that's going on with them will be dealt with. Because if you use a hammer for everybody, you're not going to get a good result. You have to cater it to what was going on. So that's how I built the practice.
So how much pushback did you get either from the trainers themselves or the athletes, I imagine, adored you, or other specialists or people in your own department that supposedly raised you to work a certain way?
My boss hated me. He pretty much told me, I'm not supposed to do this. You're doing everything you're not supposed to. I said, well, that sounds like me. And I remember I left. I applied for the physical therapy board. And they said, okay, your classes are good. Your grades are fine. All we need is your volunteer hours. I said, awesome. I have 5,000 working for these teams. They said, oh yeah, those don't count. We want hospital. So you need to go work for free for another year.
Oh my God. So did you?
No. I said, I have more experience than 90% of the people coming out of your doctoral program. I've done surgery on people. I mean, we were like the first line of care for these guys. So when something would happen, we had to patch them up. We were everything from a paramedic to an EMT to a microsurgeon. We did everything under that veil. So I had so much experience. I was like, I'm not going to go work for free in a hospital setting where they make me file paperwork. So massage was the lowest barrier to entry to what I was already doing. And I didn't have this governing body that was saying, you can't do this, you can't do this. I'm like, well, let me do that. I got the license in like 15 minutes. And back then, the criteria was a lot easier because massage was labeled as prostitution. And then just started the business after that.
I just want to clarify a couple of things for listeners, because when you say the training room, for people who don't follow sports, you mean the collegiate athlete hub.
Yes. Yeah. So if you go to a sporting event or you go to the training center for the Raiders or some major athletic team, they have a training center within their training center. So you've got all the athletics, but then you've got the medical side of it. And we were in the medical side of it for the college side.
Mm-hmm. And why didn't you go into professional sport training hubs after that? Why did you choose to start your own practice instead?
I thought about it. In athletics, you have somebody who's extremely good physical fitness, and then they get hit by a wall or they break something. You know exactly where that problem happened. So this is the problem. This is the solution. Where in general population, you have 20, 30, 40 years of life that happened. And then you have to discover and decipher what came from that. It was like a puzzle that you could figure it out.
It makes sense to me that diagnosis is a particular interest of yours, because it keeps it interesting. In addition, you also have ambition, not mm-hmm. just for yourself, because I know you had a child young, so there were mm-hmm. a lot of responsibilities in that, but you also want to spread this work and what you know, because clearly there's a lot of disciplines out there that aren't very effective. So I love that you're revolutionizing a lot of these disciplines that are as limited as they are, even though I gather you're still getting a lot of pushback. So I'd love for you to talk about first, what is unusual about your approach and why is it a shit disturbing, shall we say? The previous powers that have been and are.
There's a lot of great PTs out there. There's a lot of people that are conscious and treat their patients and do amazing work. My issue is the rigidity in all the professions. I found this through chiro, through PT, through even orthopedics and Western medicines, even acupuncture and things like that. Acupuncture is a little bit more open, but they're so determined that what they do is the only way to do something that gets really frustrating. Because if somebody presents me a good way to do something, you give me a good enough argument, I'll adopt it. Because if this person can get better or get out of pain or have a happier life because I have another tool that I can use that better fits them, perfect. PT has a lot of great tools. Chiro has a lot of great tools. Orthopedics has a lot of great tools, but why do they have to be so segmented? Why can't they intermingle or say, well, this is my lane. I can only do this because this is the lobby I have. This is the bureaucratic side that I have. And I have to own these words and these treatments for me because this is the only way I can bill through insurance. Because if I start opening it up, I can't make, it's all money-based. The way I look at it is I'm pissed upon because yes, as a massage therapist, I can't diagnose. I recommend. But I'm looking at it as a bigger picture, because instead of saying, all right, I have a script from a doc that says this person's shoulder needs rehab, I can look at that person and say, all right, yeah, your shoulder's messed up. Why? Where is it coming from? Well, it's because you stubbed your toe 6 months ago. You started walking funny. That threw your hips in one direction, that threw your chest in another direction. Then your shoulder went bad. Now you got migraines too. So that path needs to be at least acknowledged and dealt with. But instead, because of the system, you're focused on that one piece and they're in therapy for months and months and months. And you're doing the exact same thing that has been taught for the last 60 years. And there's not a whole lot of innovation. And I'm sure a lot of people get mad at me for saying that because there is innovation, but I just don't understand why it's so hard to say, well, you know what? this person presented me with an option that might be interesting. I'd like to learn more about it. And that's all I'm saying. I'm not poo-pooing any of it. I'm just saying, keep an open mind.
Yeah, again, I would say part of why you're able to do that is because you have both inquisitiveness and you also have the brain, the mind plasticity to be able to integrate these things, which a lot of people don't. They're not necessarily creative enough or flexible enough to be able to do that. So what a gift it is that you're helping do that for a lot of people out there who might not be able to trailblaze the way you are, but can certainly learn from your innovations and integrations.
I was just at a job fair for one of the massage therapy companies, seeing what they're churning out in this industry. It's almost following the same path we were talking about. They're like, oh, well, you're only doing energy work. You're only doing cranial sacral. You're only doing this. And some kid came up to me. I thought this is really what I want. I wanted to do, what did she say? Sports massage or something, which is obscenely general. It doesn't really mean much of anything. And then somebody else told her, no, you'd be much better at this. And my comment to that was, why can't you do both?
Yeah.
I said, learn as much as you possibly can. That way your toolbox is so big that you can help a bunch of people. When you pigeonhole yourself into one specific little thing, your demographic goes to this and your knowledge base goes to this, which is super tiny. And what good are you? So even if this might not be your expert level today, what's to say it won't be in a year or two when you actually do it a few times? You've been in school for 10 minutes. Don't close yourself off right at the beginning, but it's that same mentality. Everybody wants to put you in a box. Go to this box, do that. Don't leave outside that box.
Unfortunately, massage therapy, as it's trying to legitimize itself out of the prostitution association, and also just being, it's really a peeve of mine because massage therapy obviously helps so many people and yet deemed as you're the help or you're a second class professional. And it's really frustrating because as you and I know, it's actually can be profoundly transformational for people, not just physically, but emotionally, psychologically, spiritually, et cetera, et cetera. And it's a profession that is so underrated, except by those who actually know to get the benefits from it and have the good fortune to go to an expert practitioner. So I just wanted to talk a little more about the status of massage therapists. And I know this about you, that you were very close to getting numerous credentials, which you chose not to do. Mm-hmm. And I'd like you to talk more about why not, and why at this point you don't get one of these monikers that could help potentially your credibility, shall we say, sure, to help spread your novel approach.
For many years, if we're going deep, I had huge imposter syndrome because I didn't have the pieces of paper. I apprenticed under multiple modalities, under pretty much the best of the best. And I learned the old-fashioned way. I learned by doing it and seeing it and doing it and seeing it. I didn't have the book learning as much, but that doesn't mean I didn't do the book learning as well. On my own, you don't have to go to a school to learn something. Everything's out there and you read a lot and you absorb a lot. For years and years, and to this day, any chance I can get, there's a chunk of knowledge, I will absorb it as much as I possibly can. And I usually know it a lot better than the people that went through the school because I put myself through that piece. Just because I am not accredited by a governing body doesn't mean that I don't know what I'm doing. And also, I didn't like the philosophies. So if I put this label on myself that I have X degree and I am X practitioner, now I'm not only pigeonholed into that, but now I'm forced to be by their guidelines, which are extremely rigid and extremely scrutinized too. So you have this giant lens on you that is so heavy that I can't help anybody because it's not within my bounds. The massage world, because it's so vague, it allowed me to do a lot more than if I did get that degree, because then I'd have to do only that. And that always frustrated the crap out of me. But every time I thought about, well, I'll just get the piece of paper to hang on my wall, I'd start going at it, not to be arrogant, but I knew more than most of the teachers because I'd had more experience at it. And it would be a lot of money and a lot of time away from my family and away from the business. I kept trying to justify, would it make me more money? Would it give me, and it didn't. And now the funny thing is I'm stepping more away from the actual work and I'm doing more of the business side of it because I've done my hours. I'm tired. I like doing the work. I don't like doing it in the volume that I am. And I'm trying to be more the entrepreneur side than just the therapist side, which means I really don't need the pieces of paper. But yeah, I can't tell you how many nights I was up just banging my head against the wall thinking, what the hell are you doing? You don't know what you're talking about because you don't have this legitimacy. And somebody would come up to me and they're like, you're nothing. You don't know anything. And it would be some kid in school because they're going through that process. But I'm like, I make 5 times as much as you. I've helped 100 times more people than you have. What box are you standing on? There was a justification there for me. But in the back of my head, there's still that you're a failure. You don't know what you're doing.
Imposter syndrome has its good uses, doesn't it? It tells you to continue to strive and explore and integrate and get to where you are now. So power to we imposters. I can really relate to this because I also chose not to get a master's and a PhD numerous times because I just thought, no, I'm an experiential learner, which is, it sounds like you are as well. I want to be in the trenches with the folks I'm working with to figure it out myself with my own innovation. So I'm with you. Anything else you want to say, though, about the status of massage therapy in the world in relation to both the governing forces that be and clients themselves or other disciplines?
Well, when you and I started, we were prostitutes. That's what the licensing was. That was the governing bodies. That was how it was viewed. We had to get an AIDS test and a herpes test every single time to renew our license.
I went back to 1980 before any of that stuff existed.
Mm-hmm. When I opened my shop, we weren't allowed to have doors on the rooms so the inspectors could see if there was hanky-panky going on. So time they'd come by, I'd have a hammer and a screwdriver and I'd pop off all the doors because I had some friend at the city saying, by the way, they're going to be there in an hour. And I'd them all off and back on.
I missed that part. I think it maybe because I grew up in the Bay Area. I was up in hippie town, Sausalito and Marin. So I didn't go through all of that. Wow, really?
The Gestapo was our governing body in the city.
I want to segue a little bit here because I had a conversation recently with a friend of mine, a man who's a massage therapist. Do you think part of it was exacerbated because you're a male touching bodies, that it was harder for you in some ways, not with the potential accusation of being a prostitute, but more a perpetrator?
I always thought I was at a disadvantage because I was male in the industry.
Yeah.
Because men were not successful in this world. They were not seen. They were seen as fluffy. There was a lot of negative connotations and people, especially men, were like, I don't need no guy touching me. You had the machismo side of the population that didn't want you to be there. And then you had the female side, which was, I'm scared of a man because is he going to try to do something he's not supposed to? So city aside, that was the first battle I had to go through. And I'm like, why the hell am I going into this? There's so many strikes against me before I even walk through the door. And then you've got the city saying, this is what you are. You're nothing. And you're a bane of our existence. The irony is the city that was ridiculing me the most, I treated 80% of the city hall at the time.
Oh my God.
The city has lost the power of having to regulate it in a certain way, which was nicer because it opened it all up. Now I see it all coming back again. So just a couple of years ago, the city I'm in, they had a meeting and deemed us all prostitutes again. And so the normal fee for, let's say, a business for if you were an attorney is about $40 a year. For me, it's $5,000.
Really?
For the exact same license. It acts as a deterrent. But why not just penalize the ones that you know are bad? You know who they are.
Exactly.
Instead of penalizing the entire group. The inefficiency is amazing. But it's like you're constantly fighting uphill.
Yeah, I always figure that the people who are going to perpetrate are going to perpetrate regardless. And all the people, which is 90 whatever percent of practitioners, aren't going to perpetrate whether they're penalized or not. It's just ridiculous. Okay, well, what do you think needs to happen for massage therapy to gain more respect?
That's been the debate over the years because anytime you try to get respect, the way this society does it is by, all right, we're going to create an educational system. We're going to make a school that now says you have to pass through all these hoops and learn all this stuff that is not pertaining to what you do and pay a bunch of money, and then you will be validated. I don't know if that's the direction, but I think there should be a way to either legalize the stuff that they don't want.
Yeah.
And it's going to happen anyway. So just say, we're going to put that in a different category. And this is the therapeutic side.
I love that. I'm all for that.
Put two different ways to it. If you want to put governing bodies where you do have an educational system that allows them to do what they really should be doing, opposed to just teaching them patterns, because the massage schools teach the bare minimum of anatomy, a bare minimum of physiology. Yeah. It's strokes, which is not what the profession is. I mean, I always wanted to create a school, but I didn't want to deal with the governing bodies because it would be a nightmare. Because now you're asking the system to adopt to you, and the system doesn't like change at all. It likes going backwards, but it doesn't like moving forward.
So are we just fucked or what?
Yeah, pretty much. But the irony is, as there is less eyes on it, we have more freedom to do things. The more eyes on it, then it creates more scrutiny. It creates more restrictions. Anytime you get the government involved in something, they limit, they limit, they limit, and they want to control. And that control creates the same thing over and over again. There's no innovation anymore. There's no growth because it's been so constrained in this little tiny bubble so we can protect population. But what are they really protecting? So it's my soapbox for the day.
Well, ultimately, the proof's in the pudding. And if your clients are loving what you're doing, that's what really matters. Mm-hmm. If your clients feel safe, then you're not going to end up having trouble with them, regardless of what you are and aren't doing and how you are and aren't draping within a millimeter.
Yeah. I really think if there was a separation, like, okay, you want to do more of the therapeutic side. It's not PT, it's a combination of a bunch of different things. So you're not at that same level of a doctoral or whatever it is, but it's more than just a couple hours of training. And it's taught by somebody who actually knows something in that medical field. And you have some epidemiology, you have some stuff where you're like, okay, I know this disorder, I know this disease, this is what happens with it, this is how it's treated, this is where it comes from, which the therapist should know. Because they're dealing with humans every day. And if you can't recognize what's happening with somebody, you can fuck them up.
Yeah. Though I'm going to say you have a lot of diagnostic skill that I don't have. Nonetheless, I'm able to sense all kinds of things in the body, minute detail about what's not moving and what is moving. Though I forgot a lot of my Latin.
Same here.
Decades ago. So I just wanted to acknowledge, in a perfect world, we would be able to have the breadth of skill and sensibilities that we have. Our clients are self-selecting based on that particular amalgamation of skills and sensibilities that each practitioner has. And wouldn't it be great? It would be a great job to have, to be some governing minister of massage who gets to lie there all day and get massage. To verify for themselves, not how many entries you have on your CV or letters you have after your name or hours that you've done under the auspices of a particular institution, but just, do you know what you're doing? Is it relaxing? Is it transformational? Is it alleviating pain and stress and duress? That's what I'd like to see happen, is to be verified and credentialed based on what they are actually able to do.
I'd love to see some integration. Why can't we work hand in hand with PTs and chiros and orthopedics? I think that would be a better use of our skill set. If you said, you know what, this person does really well with this, this person does really well with that, and you're going to get an integrated approach so we can get that person better faster and more efficiently, opposed to, well, this is the only thing we have.
Yeah. When I was first starting out, I worked in a chiropractic office, and without a doubt, people's adjustments held longer. Sure. They needed far fewer of them. They were much more gentle. It was an obvious augmentation and complement to what the chiropractor was doing. Of course, you and I know this, but other people may not. And this has certainly caught on. And there's all kinds of chiropractic offices where
the chiros have adopted it more, but it's the more Western medical stuff hasn't.
Yeah. Exactly. That would be amazing. Though right now there's finally acupuncture in hospitals. So mm-hmm.
That's true.
It's happening.
Hello, Brilliant Bodies. Just a short interruption to share some exciting news from our first guest, integral anatomist Gil Headley, featured in the episode, The Body is a Gift, A Reverential Journey into the Human Body. Gil has now embarked on a one-of-a-kind tour of the U.S. and beyond to share his gobsmacking presentation, The Nerve Project, Exploring the Nerve Tree in Relationship. Having personally attended, I gotta tell you, this experience will rock your world and expand your appreciation of how brilliantly designed our bodies, specifically our nerve tree, really is. Simply put, nothing has been done quite like this before, and Gil is very excited to share this groundbreaking work with you. To find more information and tickets, go to his website at www.gilheadley.com/the-nerve-tour. All information is on the show notes below. So don't miss out. Reserve your tickets now. Your body being will thank you for it.
Hey, so I want to ask you, you have a particular sensibility, and I would go so far as to say a sixth or seventh sense about pain, how structure is causing and being influenced by whatever has gone on, like you just described about hitting your toe and then the whole chain of events cascading, in that case, up the body. I wasn't sure I would ask you about this or we'd talk about this, but sometimes I have wondered if you dumb down in ways, specifically in your healing capacity, and perhaps it's for other reasons, but you're such a fix-it person. You're so affable. You use your humor all the time to disarm people in all these ways you've been describing. But I wondered if also as a healer in your own right as well, whether you keep that on the down low intentionally.
Oh, all my energy stuff?
Yes.
Oh, yes. I don't tell most people about it because not a lot will understand. It can be off-putting to some, and some will absorb it and go wholeheartedly into it. I rather just do it and not tell them. That's how I do it. I'm selective in who I let into that world or that piece of me, because when it's called upon, it comes. When it's forced, it doesn't for me. I'm not one of those that can just, everything's perfect, great. You need this. This is what you want. Because then it creates an unrealistic expectation.
So what is it?
What is it? You want me to go into that story?
I don't know. I haven't heard that story before.
Okay. Probably about 20 years ago, I was working on a guy and I waved my hand over him to reach for something and I felt a ripple. I felt a bump and I was like, what the hell is this? And I kept going over and I'm like, okay, I'm not touching him. Why do I feel a bump somewhere? Then I touched him and there was a mass right over where that bump in the air was. And I put my hand over it just intuitively. He's like, what are you doing? It's getting really hot. I'm like, I don't know. My hand turned to fire. I got a tingle up the back of my neck. He felt like I was burning him. And then 2 seconds, it all stopped. And then the ripple was gone and the bump was gone. He's like, what the hell did you just do? I was like, I have no clue. That was really weird. And I had a guy working for me at the time that was big into the Reiki world. And I told him about it. He's like, oh yeah, it's Reiki, it's energy. Come to the circle in Venice. I was like, oh God, I'm coming to an energy circle in Venice. I'm going to die now. And they laid me down on a table and I had probably 20 people doing energy work on me at the same time. And my feet were on fire to the point I couldn't walk for the rest of the night. It was like I was walking on hot coals. And whatever the hell that did, opened something in me that was dormant. And after that, I started doing some really weird stuff. I could scan somebody and see everything. It was like an x-ray. I could see everything that was going on in them. I could feel everything that was going on in them. Somebody would walk toward me. I'm like, is your left knee hurting? They're like, why? Because mine is now. I could feel it exactly where and what was going on. And then it got to the point that I could manipulate it. I could take whatever they had and either sedate it or make it bigger or take it away. It got very intense to the point that I used to say to my ex-wife, I'm on. She's like, what do you mean? And she'd be sitting across the wall. And I put my hand up and she'd feel this wave of heat smack her in the face. She's like, you're weird. I'm like, I know. But yeah, it was intense for a really long time. And then it got to the point that I could do a really intense stuff. But then this one guy walked in and I said, what'd you do to your shin? He's like, oh, I ran into a chair at the airport. And I pulled back the sheet, it was black and blue and purple. So I started doing my thing and I felt it go up my arm into my chest. And I actually had to run out because I threw up. Mm. And I came back and the bruise was gone. Mm. And that scared the crap out of me. And it scared the crap out of him. And I couldn't do it for about 6-7 years after that. Mm. It shut down on me. And then I was dating this girl in San Francisco and she's like, I've got this cyst on my breast and the doc says it's benign, but it hurts. Do your voodoo thing. I said, my voodoo thing? And she said, yeah, with her, it kicked back on, tingle up the back of my neck. The cyst went from, you could palpate it to about the size of a quarter to the size of a pinhead in about a minute and a half. And after that, I can do it again. It's not as intense as back then, but I can turn it on and off. That will.
So I can understand why you wouldn't want to tell people about this. And I find it interesting that nonetheless, this isn't what you're offering or talk about in your practice. In fact, I didn't know about this and I've known you for at least 10 years. So I'm curious about why your practice tends to be more about structural fixing, decompensating people rather than doing this energy work and profound healing.
The irony is it is. I just do it behind the scenes. So I like to think a lot of my diagnostic skills and why I can see where things are coming is from that. So it's not verbalized, but I'm using it every single day. And because I've learned that people that verbalize that side more get lumped into a box and get delegitimized because it's not as well accepted. Yes, is it there? Is it true? But the people that say, all I do is energy work, it's a certain type too. And I didn't want to be pigeonholed into that. So it's another tool in my belt that I can use. Do I need it all the time? No. Do I want to be known for that? No, because it takes a lot out of me. It drains me heavily.
You may not be able to teach people how to perceive bodies in this X-ray kind of way, which most people can't. On the other hand, people do have different ways of perceiving, of course, that can have even miraculous influence on how they behave as practitioners and how they work as practitioners, even without being conscious of that happening. Mm-hmm. So I think that's really important because I can imagine if practitioners are listening, they could think, oh my God, I can't see into somebody's breast tissues in that way, or I can't know that their problem is actually coming from their gallbladder and that's why their left knee won't heal. And yet on one hand, all the things that I imagine this spidey sense of yours can perceive is so beautiful and impressive. And people obviously all have their own gifts and perceive in the way.
Exactly. And how I perceive things and how I describe it might be completely different than somebody else doing it. It's like a radio frequency. Mm-hmm. Some people can tune into different frequencies. Some people are more the ethereal past lives. I know a guy that can do that. He can tune into that frequency and talk to dead people. And it freaks me out. But that's his radio frequency. Mine is this. Yours is a different one. And everybody can feel it. It just depends how you perceive it. You walk into a room where everybody's been fired. You don't have to talk to anybody. You know something's wrong because a wall hits you as you walk through that door. That's that energetic feeling that's coming off of all those people. I don't know if it's not teachable. I think people either have it or they don't, but you can be taught to turn your knob a little bit and kind of fine tune into things.
Well, this is why I call my podcast The Brilliant Body, because this is in that whole realm of how do we do this? What is this? And as you say, we all have a different frequency that we attune to consciously or not. And some of us make professions out of what that frequency is that we're able to hear or feel or perceive. So I'm just curious, what else do you know or think about this capacity, regardless of how varied it is in each of us? What is it, whether it's mirror neurons or the morphogenetic field, or that we're just fleshy geniuses who go around understanding our environment, at least on a physical and conscious level, far more than we give ourselves credit for?
I think I was watching Nova or something the other day, and it was talking about how trees in a forest are all interconnected. Their root systems and their energetic. One can say, there's a bark beetle over here, watch out, start excreting this 100 miles away, and that tree will do it. So I don't think we're too far off of that. It might not be a root system, but there's an interconnectedness between every human being.
Yeah, I was talking about that on a different episode. Yeah,
I love that's how I see it. We're all hooked together in one way or another. It's just how we perceive that matrix. Some of us can push more of that veil away and see what's there. And some of us are very locked down and don't want to see anything.
Yeah.
So what is it? I have no clue. But there is definitely something that's electricity or energy or some sort of, I wish I had a word for it. It just is there. There is something that connects us all together. And you can either choose consciously or unconsciously to see it, and how you use that knowledge differentiates us, because you're going to heal in the way that you are. I'm going to do mine. The past life guy is going to see his pieces and how he's going to do it. And then you got Joe Schmo over here that doesn't even know what they're doing, but they can tell something's happening. They can tell when the market's going to change. They can tell when somebody's going to be sad or their kid's going to have this thing. I'm a parent. You know what's going on with your children, not just because you know your kids, because energetically you're attached to them.
Yeah.
You have this connection where you're like, I know exactly what he needs and what's going on and where it's coming from, because you have that bond. And that bond is not just between parent and child. It's with all of us. It's just, again, what you choose to allow yourself to see.
So beautifully expressed. Thanks for saying all that. I want to go more into the verb fix. Mm-hmm. Because there's a lot of people in the healing world who are like, it's not about fixing. And I want to know what your retort or your response is to that.
I was listening to a bunch of osteopaths that I respect, and they're like, we don't fix anything. And I said, yeah, but I tell people, I'm not fixing this. I'm telling your body, this is where it would like to be better. Mm-hmm. It will choose to say, hey, this is prettier over here. I'm going to go. So I'm less of a, okay, I'm taking out the carburetor and I'm putting a new one in. I'm more along the lines of showing the body what it needs to do to be at optimal state, and then gently guiding it till it can see that new path. That's probably the best way to do it. So actually, we don't fix, we advise. Because we encourage where it wants to go.
Say educate. Which is so much more open, because first of all, it gives the recipient, the student body in this case, the agency to accept that information or not, accept that advice or palpable suggestion, intervention, I would even say, or not. Whereas fixing implies so much that it's being done to you and mm-hmm. passive recipient. So I love that distinction. I'm glad I asked you about that, because that said, I do think of you as being a fixer. And I know that if I go to you, you're going to be able to fix that rib. And it is part of a whole network, of course, as we've been talking about, of other physical and emotional issues. So thank you for that. I'm glad I asked you. Two more things I want to ask you before we wrap up. Dealing with jealousy and hatred coming at you now that you're getting more out into the world. I know you're branching more and more into social media. You're getting your work out through videos and programs, which I want to also invite you to talk about if you want to. And I'm just wondering, how do you deal with that, particularly being as energetically sensitive as now we know you are? What is that like when you know you're bursting a lot of bubbles? And these aren't just mean, nasty people out there who just want to troll and make trouble. These are other professionals we assume are decent people who are just offended or freaked out by what you know and they don't. How are you dealing with it? How do you feel like you're going to deal with it as you get more and more visible?
I kind of stayed a really low profile for a long time because I didn't want the scrutiny, because I knew I didn't fit into a box. And this society loves boxes. And if they can't put you in one, it's uncomfortable. So being more outward on social media, I'm very, very selective on what I show and what I do. And when I do get pushback, at first it hits me. I feel like it's a personal attack. I'm like, this person doesn't really know who I am or anything. Why are they so mean? And then I almost repeat this in my head. It's not me, it's them.
Yeah,
they're going through something. This is the only way they know how to express themselves, because it's coming out, but it still hurts, still sucks. But I'm in integrity. I'm doing what I know, and I'm helping a lot of people, and that's my mission. So as long as I stay on that path and that do no harm, help others and go forward with it, you learn to become a little numb to it. But I've had a lot of celebrity clients over the years that they're like, we don't read the comments because it makes us sick. And it does. And I've had a couple nights where I'm nauseous from reading the stuff because I'm like, what does this mean? Where is it coming from? I think like the Elon Musks are so numb to it that they're like, it doesn't, they don't let it in. Unfortunately, we're both too empathic to not let it in. It hits us at our soul because it goes back to that imposter syndrome stuff, because it brings it all up. It brings all those doubts and those questions you had. And then you've moved way past that and you're in a more stable, secure space. But then those little things, it's like your parents, you know, you can be 40s, 50s, 60s, your dad or your mom says something and you're 5 again and you're an emotional wreck.
Well, I think it's easy to forget or not remember that actually that self-doubt often is coming from them. And we're thinking it's ours because it's analogous to our own. I mean, that happened even today with the driver. Somebody pulled out in front of me from an alley. It was clearly their mistake. And yet he yelled at me as if it was my fault. And I thought, wow, blaming for making a mistake, blaming the other person, which of course we see every day in the headlines, what's going on and has gotten so common is I did wrong. I can't handle it. It makes me feel too inadequate. So I'm going to blame you.
Oh, yeah. It's much easier to push it on somebody else.
It's much easier. And yet, for a moment there, I started feeling this weird, hard anger in my heart. And I realized, oh, that's what that dude's feeling. You know, that anger and hard-heartedness wasn't even my response to being blamed and treated badly. It was what that dude was experiencing and what enabled him to respond the way he did. So listening to you, I'm like, yeah, all these people who are just, they feel like imposters and they're just putting it on you because you're actually getting the results.
I'm petrified at what our society is heading toward and is already there. I think after COVID, everybody became so insulated that anything that happened outside in the world, they had no coping skills. So now when they have to deal and interact with people, everybody's a victim. Everybody's in this state where you said one word to me, I'm damaged forever. But what about my own accountability? What about my own actions? Instead of taking it into me, how can I make things better? How can I create an environment that is healthy and loving and inclusive? It's all, you're bad. You're bad and you're the reason why everything's terrible. And what that does is it keeps pushing it down the line and pushing down the line, and nobody's accountable anymore for anything. And then you have anarchy, especially with social media. It's so anonymous that there's no repercussions. It's easy to destroy somebody and easy to cancel somebody. And it's scary. It's scary how it's become where it used to be, you know what? You do a good job. You do this. You help people. Great. That's all that matters. Now it's public opinion.
Yeah. Have you seen any particular change? I don't like using this word in this context, but a physical trend in your clients since COVID, how their bodies have changed?
Oh my God. Like, anxiety.
And how that's showing up in their actual physical patterns?
I've gotten more people with crippling anxiety than anything else that is physically manifested. They're creating physicalities to justify their anxiety. I can't go out because of this. I can't do this because of this. And it's all to prevent socialization, prevent them from leaving their front door. And younger and younger.
I mean, their bodies are misfiring or malfunctioning or just pained so that they don't have to leave their homes.
They're creating the pain to cause it. Because if it went away, they'd have to go outside.
Yeah. Wow.
See, you didn't help me. No, I did. You just don't want to. And it's obscenely apparent. So with those, it's less about the physicality on how you deal with them. It's getting to the root of where that anxiety is coming from, giving them tools to say, okay, what can we do to do baby steps to slowly reintegrate you into normal functionality and try this little piece. How did you do? Okay, now take a step back. And it's such a slow process that that has to happen first. And then the physical stuff will drop off on its own. And I've seen it time and time again. I keep getting these people that are scared to death of the world. And it's because they were told, don't go outside. You're going to die. Everything's going to go to hell. And they believed it and they adopted it and they never got out of it. It's sad. And the kids, I've got 15 to 22 year olds that have so much anxiety and non-functionality, they can't do anything. They're scared of everything. Wow. So I don't know what that means going forward.
The suggestions you give, are they usually physical things or can they be also psychological? You give an example, because one of the things I wanted to ask you is, what do you think would make the most difference in our having happier, more comfortable bodies?
It depends on what's happening with them, because each case is a little different, but it's usually giving them a step outside of their bubble while they're in their bubble. So what can you do that will allow them to still stay in their safe place, but mitigate it so you can move past it? So it's tools. So they'll catastrophize everything. I had one lady that was, she's got a house. And oh, there's rats there. I can't go there anymore because there's rats. I'm like, you saw one rat 2 years ago. It's gone now. So why don't we send this person in? Okay, we're going to do that. They cleaned it all and everything. Okay, now you're not going to stay the night. You're just going to step in the door and look around. Is everything okay? Great. Now we're going to step back out. And the next time we're going to go with somebody else. Okay, great. Now you're going to stay there for 15 minutes. Now it's integrating them back into that functionality. And what it got her to do is within about a month, she was living and staying in the house again. She was going to sell it and she's not going to sell it now. Now it's profitable. So it's how do you work their mindset without pushing so hard that they're like, no, I can't do that. That allows them to see it's safe. So that's how I did it.
Some people would say that's moving out of your lane, even with you have a psychology degree. And yet there you have it. If ultimately, as you had stated before, what your goal is to help educate people to be much more comfortable in their bodies and hopefully pain-free and fully functional.
I had this patient for a long, long time, and she was seeing a psychologist, and she'd always tell me, she's like, so what did Holden tell you to do? That sounds like a good idea.
So what would you say your mission is? You used that word earlier. So I wanted to ask you, what is your mission and why do you care about bodies in pain as much as you do, that you've developed this supersonic capacity to detect it in people?
My mission was to help people along their path to get to wherever they really want to go. And where others have failed them and they feel that they've been neglected or given up on or passed along, that's usually when I see them. We did a group building with my team and we're trying to figure out what's the words that describe what we do. We had all these things on the board. And the one thing that just kept coming back, and that was our main thing, was hope. Wow. We give hope. We give hope to people that don't have hope. Wow. And we give solutions to that. So it's not just, here's the hope, but look, here's an actual way to get to where you want to get to.
So touched by that, Holden. So beautiful. It does make me question, though, whether this feels burdensome to you at times.
It can get a lot. I used to get hate mail every time I go on vacation because they'd be like, I'm dying. How can you go? Where are you? Because you take people that are in chronic pain for really long periods of time, and then you show them that they don't have to be in that. So their coping skills used to be huge because they could suppress and suppress and suppress. You finally get them out of that pain, their coping skills are gone because they're like, I get to live life. So the second they feel it again, they freak out because they're like, I don't want to go back to that.
I thought you were going to say, as you were talking about earlier, that the pain is part of their coping skill and they don't know, they feel lost or confused when they don't have that pain there to mitigate their other anxieties.
I think it's two different personalities. It's ones that are actually in chronic pain that want to be out of it. Emotionally, they're mentally ready not to be there. And they haven't been able to get past that. When you can say, oh, it's this, and then 20 minutes later, they're not in pain anymore, and it stays, where like 40 other practitioners have failed them, then you hold a huge responsibility. And they're like, wait, it came back. This is the only way to get rid of it again. Where the hell is he? So that's a huge dynamic, because I've been telling my clients lately, you know, I'm stepping back. I'm taking some hours off. I'm not working as many days. I'm trying to expand the business. I've kind of paid my dues and I need to take care of myself a little bit more because a lot's happened in the last couple of years. Yeah. And they're like, okay, as long as I'm not one of those that you step back from.
Right.
Which is all of them. So it's a balancing act. I'm still there, but at least my team is getting really strong and I can get them to take up some of the slack, creating ways that they can do things themselves more. I think that's the future, opposed to being more dependent on me.
Yeah. And wouldn't it be amazing if your teachings could become curriculum in all kinds of different institutions? So power to that.
And the plan.
I got to let you go, but I do want to come back to something that my guest, Marcelo Botero, and I were talking about in another episode. And that was this thing about preference. Mm-hmm. I brought up the issue, perceptual preference, that pain, I know in my own body, can become like a preference of what I tend to attend to. And it's not out of pleasure that I like to attend to my pain. It's in part out of defensiveness and fear and different things, but it's also a neurological habit. And I was just curious, looping back to what we were saying, that there are some people that get dependent on being in pain or even chronic pain, in part to avoid going out into the world or avoid having to do X, Y, or Z. And I was curious what you had to say about that, if you wanted to add anything to preference for pain.
So I wouldn't say it is preference as much. I would say it is identity.
Yeah.
So people use pain as their identity. Because if you get somebody who all I talk about is this is always hurting, this is terrible, that's what their conversations are. That's how they identify themselves. That's how they get interaction. That's how they get sympathy. So if my ability to converse with others is limited, but the thing I know I can get a response from is pain and me talking about that pain, that identifiable factor doesn't only go to the point that it's, I have this, but I'm rewarded for it.
Yeah.
Because I get the attention and I get the compassion and I'm not getting that in other places. This allows me to have that. So that's how I see that cycle happen, because you're using the pain as an outlet to get things that you're not in other parts of your life.
I want to add from my own perspective is it's also taught me to pay more attention to my body in ways, because pain tends to be loud. Mm-hmm. It's not subtle in a lot of cases. And so it has caused me to be more embodied, I would have to mm-hmm. say, be more conscious, have more of my mind and my matter than it might be if I was flying all over the place in my thinking journeys that can be quite chronic. So I just wanted to say there's that about pain. And it's also helped me to have more compassion for myself, not just, oh, I'll get more compassion from other people. Mm-hmm. It's helped hone greater compassion for myself, at least on my good days. And I wanted to add, listening to you, that from a family constellation perspective, there's also what we call hidden loyalties, where I will be in pain as an unconscious loyalty to someone else in the family system. Mm-hmm. If whether you can call that a solidarity to a literal pain that somebody else is experiencing, but it can also be, I will stay limited. I will stay out of that relationship or stay out of excelling in my athletic prowess, or I'll stay out of X, Y, or Z, because if I were to excel or engage in those ways, then I might threaten the belonging to my family's system. I might outdo somebody in the system that I'm afraid will cost my belonging or my approval or my acceptance in that system. So I just wanted to add that in because you're inspiring me to think more about the function of pain.
Yeah. It doesn't always have to be pain. I know a lot of folks that go on this never-ending self-discovery path. Mm-hmm. They're always like, oh, I'm trying to find myself. I'm like, you've been looking for so long. It's maybe just time to start acting and start doing, opposed to constantly searching. Because it's another identifier. It's like, well, I don't actually have to live because I'm on this journey to discover myself.
Yeah.
70 years down the line, you still haven't discovered yourself and you haven't done anything either. So instead of going on that path, So pain's the same way. When I say that, don't mistake pain for actual pain. Okay, I shoveled 6 hours of snow yesterday and almost killed myself. Everything hurts. But that's because of an action that I did, and it will pass, and I can mitigate that. And then how do I mitigate that myself? Well, I can do mobility. I can take a hot bath. There's things I can do that will help me progress that path to get out of pain by myself, where if I use that as, oh, look, I'm in pain, I can't do anything ever, that's a different dynamic.
There's also just that people get into accidents because we are physical bodies in the physical world. And some people can say, well, that accident happened because you were going through X, Y, and Z and wanted to avoid this or didn't want to see this or whatever.
Or the car just hit you.
Exactly. Somebody said sometimes a fall is just a fall.
Yeah.
So the law of gravity does exist. Hey, last two questions. So how do you define embodiment?
Yeah, I saw this question on your thing. I'm like, how do I do this?
Yeah.
I define it as how you sit with yourself. How do you, hated this question, by the way.
He just said, I hated this question.
This question, yes. No. I guess embodiment to me is, who am I? What do I represent? How do I move? How do I interact with the world? So that's the closest I can get to it. Do I embody as a healer? Do I embody as a father? Do I embody as somebody out in the world? What defines me and how I present that to the world? That's how I view embodiment.
So would you say how I show up?
Yeah, much simpler.
I really appreciate that because you are a man of action, a man of principle and action and follow through. So I love that that's your definition. It's not just how I feel, how I look, how I think about myself, or how I experience myself. It's okay, and what are you going to do about it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very good analysis.
I didn't put words into your mouth, did I?
No, that's exactly what I said.
Okay, good. And what do you like best about being your body?
I like that it's still there. It hasn't failed me yet, even though I keep trying sometimes. So yeah, one of the meditations I do, I'm grateful for my heart beating, my lungs breathing, and the fact that it's my tool. A lot of people get to be a master at something. I got to master my tool that's part of me, and it's always with me. So my hands are an appendage that if I lost, I'd be very, very upset because it's a sensitivity that I don't think a lot of people have, and what I can do with them is really cool. So I'm extremely grateful for the body I have and the things it's allowed me to do.
Awesome. Anything else you want to say about what you're offering the world in terms of your programs or Mayo Align?
Well, we've got MediTouch, which is our clinic in Culver City, West Los Angeles area. We've been there for almost 30 years. If you're in pain and you can't figure out a way out of it, give us a buzz. Mayo Align, I created during COVID, which took every technique I created over the last 30 years and put it in a digestible format. So it's body part by body part. The videos are roughly 5 to 10 minutes long each. They're short, concise. this is this area, this is how you can treat this area. And then at the end of it, it goes through protocols. You got somebody with migraines, do video 1, 5, and 3, and this is how, and combines everything into it. So it's a way to show a piece of what I do, but replicate it and digest it so that it can be done over and over and over again. And they're not difficult moves to adopt. And once you understand the conceptualization of why you're doing it, that's a big piece of it too. So it's opposed to just lift the head here, move that. Why? This is where it attaches. This is what happens. This is what's the cause. This is the symptomology. This is the emotional attachment. This is how it all works together, and then do it. But this is what you're going to look for. So there's three different ways to treat one thing. This personality will deal with this way. This personality will deal with that way. And that one will deal with this. So it's not just the physicality. It's who to use on when.
Sounds absolutely brilliant, Holden, as are you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. This was a blast.
Thank you. Okay.
Take care.
Thanks so much for sticking around till the end. If you enjoyed this episode, please give that like button a little click. And if you haven't already, make sure to subscribe and hit that notification bell. I've got a bunch of fascinating guests lined up with trailblazing experts in the field that I'm really excited to share with you. I'm eager to hear from you too, so don't be shy. Drop a comment below, share your thoughts, suggestions, or just say hi. Your insights on this episode mean the world to me. So go ahead, spread some love, like, subscribe, hit the bell, and share your thoughts below. Your support keeps this channel going strong, and I'm genuinely grateful for each and every one of you. Till next time, stay brilliant.
I hope you found this episode inspiring. If you'd like to learn more about the many ways I'm encouraging and guiding the wider world to reclaim the brilliance of the body, please visit my website at www.alimezey.com. Thanks so much for listening. Until the next episode and beyond, reclaim your brilliant body. The Brilliant Body Podcast was created by Ali Mazay. This episode was co-produced and edited by Ali Mazay and Florence Popoff. Thanks to composer Blair, Mr. One Man Ben Wilson, for my theme music.